This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Available now on the documentary from the BBC World Service.
When rising sea levels threaten a country's very existence, how can its culture be preserved? Tuvalu wants to create an online archive of its language, music, and important artifacts. I'm going to find out how the government's Digital Nation plan is developing.
Listen now by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Der Dezember steckt voller Gewinne mit dem Rubbellos Adventskalender. 24 mal rubbeln, 24 mal die Chance auf festliche Sofortgewinne. Mit Gesamtgewinnen von mehr als 4,5 Millionen Euro über alle Winterlose hinweg. Ich bin dann mal weg.
Rubbellose, das schnellste Glück von Lotto. Chance auf einen der Höchstgewinne, siehe Rückseite der Lose.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm Paul Henley. Diabetes has long been a health scourge of some of the world's wealthiest countries. Since 1990, new research suggests that the number of cases has doubled globally, and developing countries are showing the biggest increases. The name diabetes is given to a group of chronic diseases characterised by high blood sugar levels, suffered by more than 10% of adults worldwide. It can lead to serious health issues and death if it goes untreated. The most common type, type 2, is often associated with lower income people who have less than healthy diets. Dr. Majid Ezati from the Global Environmental Health Programme at Imperial College London is senior author of the new research. He told me this scale of diabetes was an avoidable crisis.
So diabetes is increasingly manageable with detecting it early and using effective treatments and getting the patients to hopefully supporting them to change their diet. What our study shows that for much of the world's population, actually, they are not getting the treatment, and that's happening because they are not even getting the diagnosis that they need. So a large number of people living with diabetes for years, which means that it's going to affect just about every organ in their body and lead to early death and a lot of disability.
And it's an uneven increase, isn't it, across developed and developing countries?
It is really uneven. And a part of it is across developed and developing countries. And a part of it is just particular region of the world. So in Europe, especially in Northern Europe, there has been just about no increase except for people getting older. So generally, diabetes rates are higher in older ages. So main effect has been aging. In many parts of the developing world, and especially in parts of Asia, the Caribbean, the Pacific Islands, the rates have become extremely high. So we are talking about countries that more than one in four people are living with diabetes, and some of them one in three people living with diabetes.
What kinds of diet are associated with type 2 diabetes in particular?
It's both certain things that we eat and some of the things that we do not eat. So any form of processed carbohydrates, it's bad. Whether it's sugar in sugary drinks, whether it's bleached flour and white rice that people are, if they can afford it, they may eat higher amounts of it. The things that we are not eating are things such as fibers. They are very good for actually reducing diabetes risk. Some kinds of dairy, so especially fermented dairy like yogurt and at lower fat contents, fresh vegetables and fruits. So we are completely shifting the balance from things that are good, but unfortunately more costly and harder to get, to things that are much lower cost, processed carbohydrates and bad for people.
And presumably the amount of risk you face if you have diabetes depends on how well developed your healthcare system is where you live.
Absolutely. A healthcare system that deals with diabetes well is one that people have regular contact with it, which means that it should be free at the point of use. It means that it should be equipped. It should have the equipment, the guidance, the personnel to actually screen people and test them. And if they are test them, medicines should be free for them, and there should be a regular supply that people can get them and support them.
India accounts for more than a quarter of the world's diabetes sufferers. Put that in context, would you?
Sure. I mean, India obviously is a big country, so that's a big part of this story. But countries in South Asia in particular seem to have had some of the largest increases. Obesity has gone up, but it has gone up for the same increase in obesity faster than other places. And people are increasingly actually aware of this, that especially populations in South Asia and some of the other indigenous populations, in islands, are more susceptible to diabetes at any level of obesity.
You'll be stating the obvious to an extent, but spell out how we can reverse this trend.
I think it will have to be a combination of both the health sector and outside the health sector. So we really should be making healthy foods affordable. So we would want to make healthy foods, legumes, high fiber foods, fresh vegetables, fresh fruits, good dairy, affordable and accessible to people. But we also need health systems that actually elevate diabetes to say, look, it is disabling for life and it is fatal at early age. And so we have to actually equip the health systems to catch it early.
Dr. Majid Ezzati, Professor of Imperial College London. Now, Barbados in the Caribbean is an example of somewhere where levels of diabetes are rising fast and are particularly high. Dr. Diane Brathwaite is from the Barbados Diabetes Foundation. She began by telling me what the situation was on the island.
Our rates are pretty high. Our last prevalence rates, they were actually done a bit more accurately, on island. This was actually back in 2015 before COVID. COVID threw our life upside down, but we're talking 18.7%. I heard somebody drop a 1 in 4% today and I wanted to sink underneath the table. But the rates are going up relatively quickly.
And what is driving them? There must be a lot of factors. Tell me about the main ones.
There is, it's so multifactorial. First of all, of course, we have like our underlying genetics. I always say, remember that a lot of the Caribbean islands are very mixed populations. A high number of African, yes, descendants, but we also have Indian and Asian as well. So we are an interesting mix of people over here. And I mean, honestly and realistically, we do have to look at lifestyle. Of course, when we're talking about type 2 diabetes, that represents the majority of what we see would be type 2 diabetes. And, you know, you have the genetics, but then, of course, you have the lifestyles that are kind of compounding the issue on top of the fact that we're generally more sedentary, you know, than we would have been previously when more people were doing physical labor. You know, you had to take animals out, you were more into farming, you had to walk everywhere that you went, that kind of thing.
You perhaps associate, if you didn't know better, the place with, I don't know, an outdoor lifestyle, lots of fish in the diet. What's going wrong?
Well, we have to dial back quite a bit. And I think worldwide, what we do know is that populations such as my island and people coming from certain legacies, we do actually have a higher consumption of sugar. We have actually obviously all come up around a sugarcane industry. And we also have a history of higher salt consumptions as well. And we know that in Black people, like hypertension is driven, you know, by salt. We have diets that are higher in fat. And a lot of these kind of, I would say, practices are something that's just kind of being passed down, I think, you know, through generations, basically.
What's the government doing to try to tackle the problem?
Oh, they're doing everything. They're doing everything. Before I move on, I also want to point out that I think as people do mention that there needs to be a multi-sectorial approach towards managing diabetes and other NCDs. It can't just be the health sector. It must be everything. It must be agriculture. You know, it must be marketing. It must be commercial Barbados, etc. In Barbados, we have this very interesting dynamic where I personally think, and I can stand by that, I don't think that we necessarily have enough policies that protect people from unhealthy things. So one area that we're working on is trying to build up our policies, yes, in health. Sometimes we have some fight back from some other kind of entities within Barbados against that, simply because, you know, we're a small island. We depend on, you know, that kind of exchange between bigger countries like America and England, et cetera. When you start putting embargoes, that can affect, you know, your kind of business, if you want to put it that way, or your export. What's the government doing? We're doing a whole lot. We're going into schools. We've actually only now put in place a school nutrition policy. So the food in the schools is very different from what it looked like when I was growing up, what was being served. And the portions are much smaller as well. We've actually put on things such as sugar taxes on our beverages, and we hope to increase that. What I would love to see is that there is some kind of regulation as to the amount of sugar that's put in sugar-sweetened beverages. And if companies are not compliant with it, there is some kind of penalty towards that. And this has been done in other countries.
Dr. Diane Brathwaite from the Barbados Diabetes Foundation speaking to me from Bridgetown. Two explosions outside Brazil's Supreme Court are being treated as a terrorist act, according to police in the capital, Brasilia. They were set off by a man who died during a failed attack, late last night. He's been identified as a member of the far-right party of the former president, Jair Bolsonaro, whose supporters last year tried to seize control of democratic institutions in Brasilia, having lost the election. I've been speaking to the BBC's Leandro Praceres in Rio de Janeiro. He told me more about what happened at the Supreme Court.
Well, what we know so far is that two explosions were heard on Wednesday evening around 7:30 p.m. Near the Praça dos Três Poderes, where Brazil's Supreme Court and the Congress buildings are located. The first explosion was in a car parked close to the Congress, and the second one took place just a few seconds later in front of Brazil's Supreme Court. CCTV footage showed Mr. Luiz throwing what appeared to be a firework towards the building before he lit an explosive device, lay on the ground until the device exploded, killing him. The police informed that the man was wearing a suicide vest that had to be defused by an anti-bomb squad, and investigators went to a house he had rented 3 months ago in the suburbs of Brasilia, where they found that he had set bomb traps in the place that had to be detonated by a special robot. And at the moment, right now, the police are investigating if he was operating alone or if he had the help of other people.
And his links to the party of the former president?
Yes, it's believed that the suspect was a right-wing militant. In 2020, he ran for election in a municipality in southern Brazil, but he didn't get enough votes, and he ran for the same political party as former President Jair Bolsonaro. On social media, he posted several messages with political content criticizing left-wing politicians and Brazil's Supreme Court, which is a very common pattern these days for right-wing supporters in Brazil.
The police are clear in their statement this was a terrorist act. They'll presumably be keen to demonstrate that he was a sole perpetrator.
Yes, at the moment, as I said, the police is investigating whether he had the support of other people. What the head of federal police in Brazil said today is that there are still some extremists operating in Brazil that are sending threats to authorities, threats to politicians, especially from the left wing. But right now, the federal police is investigating whether this was an isolated episode or if it's part of something bigger.
And briefly, Brazil's hosting the G20 summit in Rio, where you are next week. Security must be being stepped up.
Well, no, actually, I've been speaking to Brazilian authorities here in Rio de Janeiro, and they have told me that there's no indication that any additional measure would be necessary as a result of the explosions in Brasilia. It's important to bear in mind the fact that officially Rio de Janeiro is already under a heavy security scheme. It's expected that at least 26,000 military personnel will work during the days when the leaders summit will take place here in Brazil.
The BBC's Leandro Prazeres talking to me there from Rio in Brazil. You're listening to the BBC World Service. We're live from London. This is NewsHour. Coming up, why the comedian Jerry Seinfeld is not predicting that the election of Donald Trump will be a bad thing for the movie industry.
Humans are not good prognosticators. We're not good predictors of things. We're good worriers. We really know how to anticipate and get anxious. We're great at that. We are not great at really seeing what's coming.
In the headlines, President Macron says France will not give in to anti-Semitism. Thousands of police are on duty in Paris at the moment for the national football team's match against Israel. And global cases of measles leapt by 20% last year, largely because of falling vaccination rates. I'm Paul Henley, and this is NewsHour, live from the BBC. Earlier this week, Russia's lower house of parliament passed a law that would ban what it called propaganda about a child-free lifestyle. The upper house is expected to rubber stamp it in the coming days. It's part of a broader effort by the Kremlin to reverse falling birth rates. Estimates vary wildly, but one study by academics in Moscow suggests that the country's population could fall as low as 67 million by the end of this century. That's under half the current total. Crassy Twig from BBC Monitoring reports now on the Kremlin's plans to future-proof the country.
You'll have heard of Russia's special military operation, but are you aware of its special demographic operation? The country's population is shrinking fast, and its leaders are alarmed. Francis Carr is one of BBC Monitoring's Russia experts.
President Putin himself said that Russia's future depended on how many people there were in the country, and that a family with many children must become the norm.
Russia's fertility rate is similar to European countries, but its death rate is much higher. And there's a number of recent factors that have accelerated the population decline, including the war in Ukraine.
The upper estimate given by US intelligence is that 200,000 Russian men have been killed fighting in Ukraine. But Russian men are simply not at home to procreate. In the autumn of 2022, when the Russian authorities declared their so-called partial mobilization, there was a huge number of people leaving the country. And one recent investigation found that around 650,000 people had still not gone back.
Russia is now pretty much functioning as a war economy. Feeding the war machine and encouraging new life seem like contradictory objectives. The dilemma how to pursue both has spawned a myriad of proposals. Veronika Malinboim is another Russia watcher from our team in Tbilisi.
The year of 2024 was named as the year of family, to promote traditional family values and find ways to provide social benefits to women who choose to have children.
Some of the measures have already been in place for several years. The most well-known one in Russia is the lump sum payment for new mothers. This was launched in 2007, originally for second children. But in 2020, this was also extended to the first child.
We have a ton of social benefits for families with three or more kids. They get various discounts, they get free transportation, children get free food at school.
But despite these financial incentives, Russian data suggests Russians are not in a hurry to have more children, so the carrot alone is not enough.
We're seeing more and more repressive measures which are aimed at trying to increase the birth rate by almost punishing people.
Various different officials are almost trying to compete in proposing the sort of more outlandish measures. Some proposing the introduction of childlessness tax. Some propose banning micro-small to one-bedroom apartments. Some say it would be good to have people move from cities to villages, because then they are bound to have more children.
The role of women is central to this push for bigger families. Access to abortion in Russia is in line with many Western countries, but the situation is changing.
What Russia is trying to do now is really limit Russians' access to abortion procedures in private clinics. In some regions, private clinics voluntarily, quote-unquote, chose not to offer this procedure.
If the demographic crisis continues, what would the consequences be? Francis Carr again.
Putin really likes to talk up the idea of a Russia that has been raised from its knees after the collapse of the Soviet Union, a country that is now standing up for itself on the international stage, If Russia's current population trajectory continues, there's no chance that Russia will have the resources, the weight, the influence to bring this vision of the future to reality.
Francis Scar ending that report from Crassy Twig. You can hear the full episode of BBC Monitoring's podcast on that subject by searching for The Global Jigsaw wherever you get your podcasts. The African Union has called a new test for Mpox a boost for the health of the continent. The AU has endorsed the quick, reliable test invented in Morocco. Mpox is caused by a virus that spread from animals and by human-to-human contact. It can be life-threatening and it's endemic in Central and Western Africa. I've been speaking to Dr. Jean Kaseya, Director General of the Africa Centre for Disease Control and Prevention, Africa CDC. He gives a warm welcome to the new Mpox test.
This test is a game changer for us in Africa. You know, for all outbreaks that we have in Africa, we need to go to beg for vaccines, medicines, diagnostics. Even for Mpox that is becoming bigger and bigger, we don't have diagnostics manufactured in Africa. We need to procure everything from other continents. And Africa CDC is pushing and leading the agenda of local manufacturing. Then we started to support this Moroccan company called Moldiag, who came with a PCR test kit. We are glad to announce that this test got 100% sensitivity and 100% specificity.
So how does the test work and how affordable is it?
When we are talking about Mpox outbreak in Africa, we are not just talking about one outbreak. We are talking about four outbreaks in one. It means we have four different clades or classes. We have clade 1A, 1B, 2A, and 2B. The clade that is killing most of our people in Africa today, that is sexually transmitted, is the clade 1B. Then with this Mpox PCR kit, we can detect if this is clade 1 or clade 2. And then we'll go for the genomic sequencing to know if it's clade 1A or 1B. But at least knowing it's a clade 1 or clade 2 is a big success, is a major achievement. And the cost, it sold at $6 per test. This is the same price that Western countries are applying for the test. Now, we negotiated as Africa CDC, due to the volume, the company will reduce the price at $5 per test. And this is just amazing.
There isn't yet a vaccine for all forms of Mpox, is there? Although I know it's being worked on. Why is testing so important in halting the spread of the disease?
When you don't have vaccines to cover all categories of people who are affected, we need to control the outbreak to have reliable testing. Testing is part of the surveillance system we are putting in place that can help us to identify quickly a person who is affected, to isolate the person, and to avoid the spreading of this outbreak.
How big is the problem? What's the Mpox situation in Africa now?
Currently, we have more than 53,000 cases with more than 1,100 deaths. Mpox is not under control. We need to do a decentralizing mechanism for testing. We need to find vaccine to vaccinate broadly all regions. And we need to reinforce the surveillance for us to avoid to see Mpox becoming a major issue in all African countries. And let me remind, for WHO, Mpox is one of the outbreaks that can become a pandemic. And we need to control that today.
That was Dr. Jean Kaseya, who is head of the Africa Centre for Disease Control. This is NewsHour. It's live from the BBC World Service here in London.
Witness the stories that have shaped our world.
On the launch pad, in the dawn light, a towering symbol of an ambitious nation.
3, 2, 1. The whole of India was watching.
Told by the people who were there.
I still don't regret that I was part of Rose Revolution. I was a witness of very exciting days.
Witness History from the BBC World Service. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Donald Trump's re-election has brought a strong reaction from the filmmaking community in Hollywood, traditionally a Democratic stronghold, with many big names expressing dismay and shock. What impact will Mr. Trump's return to the White House have on the film industry, both on mainstream and independent filmmaking? Here's Tom Brook reporting from New York.
Welcome to the Critics' Choice Documentary Awards.
The Critics' Choice Documentary Awards, one of the film world's first post-election gatherings. Hollywood, long a powerful Democratic stronghold, gave the Kamala Harris campaign numerous celebrity endorsements, but all to no avail. At this awards event, big-name industry figures mingled with lesser-known filmmakers. Some were fearful of what a new Trump administration might bring. Among them, filmmaker Zach Stewart Pontier.
It's a scary time. I think a lot of people are feeling paranoid.
There is the view that in the wake of Donald Trump's victory, a form of resistance cinema may emerge. Many think independent documentary making has a newfound importance. Actor Jeremy Piven.
I really believe that it's more important than ever, and to be truthsayers, you know, in the midst of all this junk, and to cut through it, it's a very important way of getting the word out. So I think documentaries are more important than ever.
We're now at the beginning of awards season in the US. Traditionally, these celebratory events have often been used by liberal luminaries as a platform to vent their displeasure at Republican policies and politicians. But what is going to happen now in the wake of the Democrats' defeat?
I will ask Congress to pass a bill establishing that the only genders recognized are male and female, and they are assigned at birth.
Donald Trump's opposition to transgender rights was a major part of his rhetoric in the closing days of the election campaign. Trans people, not often represented on screen, and their supporters are fearful of what might happen to the portrayal of their lives and their stories in movies in a new Trump era. Oscar-winning documentary filmmaker Ben Proudfoot.
Yeah, I mean, in light of the election, I think it's more important now than ever for documentary filmmakers to use the power of filmmaking, to use our cameras, to use our platforms, to make sure that stories are told, especially those of the trans community.
But for all the fears of Hollywood liberals over what a new Trump presidency may portend for the film industry, one of the biggest names in American show business, Jerry Seinfeld, doesn't necessarily think that much will change.
No, I think everything will be pretty close to the same as what it is.
Why is that?
I think people think big change is, big things cause big change. They sometimes do and they sometimes don't. We're not, humans are not good prognosticators. We're not good predictors of things. We're good worriers. We're good, we really know how to anticipate and get anxious. We're great at that. We are not great at really seeing what's coming.
Jerry Seinfeld ending that report from Tom Brook in New York. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Henley. President-elect Trump's nominations for his upcoming cabinet continue to cause controversy. His choice for Attorney General, Matt Gaetz, comes under particular scrutiny today as pressure grows to release a report examining allegations of sexual misconduct on Mr. Gaetz's part. A series of eye-catching choices by Mr. Trump show the president-elect's preference for absolute loyalty above experience or expertise. Fox News host Pete Hegseth, who's a combat veteran but has no experience of running big organizations, is the person chosen to be defense secretary. Here's Matt Gaetz taking a jibe at pro-abortion women, as he called them, during a rally in 2022.
Our America is a pro-life nation, proudly. Have you watched these pro-abortion, pro-murder rallies? The people are just disgusting. Why is it that the women with the least likelihood of getting pregnant are the ones most worried about having abortions. Nobody wants to impregnate you if you look like a thumb.
Well, Matt Gaetz might not have the easiest ride in his confirmation hearing in the Senate. In the lower house, the House of Representatives, he's been getting expressions of support. This is the House Speaker, Mike Johnson.
He's an accomplished attorney. He's very concerned about the lawfare that has been occurring in the Department of Justice under the Biden administration, and the fact that the American people have lost their faith in our institutions of justice because of everything that they've seen. He's a reformer in his mind and heart, and I think that he'll bring a lot to the table on that.
The U.S. Justice Department has also investigated Mr. Gaetz himself. Last year, it declined to bring charges over allegations he violated sex trafficking laws during a trip he took to the Bahamas, along with paid escorts. He was the subject of an ongoing ethics investigation in the House of Representatives into allegations of sexual misconduct, illicit drug use, and the misuse of campaign funds. Gaetz has denied all the allegations made against him. Barbara Comstock, a former Republican congressman and senior Justice Department official, had this to say about Matt Gaetz.
Matt Gaetz does not have the character, integrity, judgment, or independence to head up this large law enforcement agency that oversees the FBI, antitrust, the civil division, the criminal division. You know, this is a huge agency. He has no management experience. You know, he's not been a prosecutor or worked as a private attorney in any kind of capacity either. But it's really these character issues where he's wholly and dangerously unqualified. You know, it hasn't even been mentioned that he's had three DUIs. So like Donald Trump, he also has mugshots. So, you know, great thing for kids. Hey, get your mugshots and you too can be leading the world.
And in the last half hour, another appointment which could prove controversial has been announced. He's chosen the anti-vaxxer Robert Kennedy Jr. to be his health secretary. Let's speak to Julia Manchester, political reporter for the Hill website. She joins me now live. Julia, Robert Kennedy Jr. first. No big surprise. Why is he controversial, though?
No big surprise, but a lot of his past comments, particularly on vaccine rhetoric, on autism and the causes of autism, have, you know, created quite a bit of controversy around him. You know, he's founded one of the largest anti-vaccine organizations here in the United States. And of course, we are still a few years after the coronavirus pandemic. So it's gotten quite a bit of backlash. You know, but he's also a very interesting figure. Remember, the 2024 presidential cycle started with him running as a Democrat in the Democratic primary. But once that effort, you know, lost steam, we saw him run as an independent, then later drop out and endorse former President Trump.
And other appointments, in the light of the fact that Donald Trump was always going to reward loyalty, perhaps over experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have Matt Gaetz, for example, as you mentioned there, a very ardent supporter of the former president. He's also from the former president's now home state of Florida, you know, but certainly raising a lot of eyebrows given his very controversial history in terms of the sexual misconduct and potential sex trafficking allegations he's faced. He's been under investigation from the FBI and the Justice Department, but also by the House Ethics Committee. You, of course, have Pete Hegseth, who is a former, a Fox News Weekend host. He, of course, is a decorated combat veteran, but does not have experience leading large bureaucracies like the Department of Justice. Two of, I would say, the former president's more normal picks, though, this week have been Florida Senator Marco Rubio for Secretary of State and Florida Congressman Mike Waltz. Senator Rubio will have to go through a confirmation process in front of his colleagues in the Senate. He is well-liked by both Republicans and Democrats in the Senate. So I imagine he will face no issue getting through. With Mike Waltz as national security advisor, he does not face the same confirmation process. But there are serious questions, particularly about Matt Gaetz and whether he will actually get the votes from enough senators, Republicans and Democrats, to be confirmed.
How does the confirmation process work exactly?
You know, essentially, once the Trump administration, you know, becomes official after inauguration, you're going to have the Senate, you know, set these dates for confirmation hearings. And, you know, they will, you know, supposedly be these public hearings where you'll have senators, you know, from various committees question and sort of cross-examine each of these picks. But we know that the former president, Trump, is trying to fast-track this confirmation process and try to push through recess appointments. These are appointments are, that are, you know, used only in emergencies, but Trump is still pushing them. It's unclear whether that will actually work. We know that Republican Senator John Thune, the new Senate Majority Leader, has not exactly signaled whether he will go along with the recess appointments, but we know that Trump and his allies are pushing for them.
Many thanks. That's Julia Manchester, who's political reporter for the Hill website. You're listening to the BBC World Service. Now, the satirical website The Onion has bought InfoWars, run by the US conspiracy theorist Alex Jones. It plans to turn the site into an online comedy platform. Jones was one of the most successful media personalities of the US far right, but courts found he'd defamed the families of the Sandy Hook school shooting when 26 people, mainly very young children, were killed in 2012. He'd claimed the killings were a hoax. He was ordered to pay the families nearly $1.5 billion. The sale of InfoWars is part of his efforts to raise that money. The Onion's bid was backed by the families of eight Sandy Hook victims. Robbie Parker's six-year-old daughter Emily was one of those killed in the mass shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary School. He's just published a book entitled A Father's Fight, Taking on Alex Jones and Reclaiming the Truth About Sandy Hook. He's been telling me about the campaign of disinformation waged by Alex Jones.
His campaign of disinformation, specifically about Sandy Hook, started within hours after the shooting. My wife and I were sitting down the street from the school waiting to find out if Emily was okay or if Emily was a victim. And at the same time, Alex Jones was in his studio sowing seeds of doubt that this was a false flag event, that it was fake and staged, and that the government was behind it. And so dealing with grief and battling conspiracy theories happened for me at the exact same time.
And a lot of people believed Jones. His followers threatened and harassed you and other Sandy Hook parents, didn't they?
No, that's correct. Emily was killed on a Friday morning, and by Sunday morning, I was already receiving threats and harassment online. And within that week, people mailing letters to my home. Before we even got to bury Emily, I was worried about my own life and the life of Emily's younger sisters and my wife.
You've been fighting to hold Alex Jones accountable. Does this auction outcome and The Onion buying InfoWars feel like a win?
It totally feels like a win, because Alex Jones, throughout this whole process, before we filed the lawsuit, never took any accountability or backed down on his claims. When we filed the lawsuit, he did everything he could to protect himself and his brand, the things that are most important to him. And so at the end of this big, long fight, 12 years for me personally and 6 years in court, to be able to say that the brand that he built for 30 years has now been taken away from him because of his own actions and what we did to hold him accountable, that is a huge win.
Do you have wider feelings and judgment on the media scene in the US more generally nowadays and its adherence or lack of adherence to the truth? Was this the start of something bigger, do you think?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I'm going to think just for a second on it because I haven't been asked that before. It's true, though. We, at least here, we have these polarizing sides and people are more focused on getting their opinion out than they are in seeking out the truth. And that's exactly why my book is about reclaiming the truth about Sandy Hook. In order for my family to heal, in order for me to reclaim Emily's memory that Alex Jones defiled, I had to combat that with the truth. And that's why in a court of law, we got to just state facts. And because of that, we were awarded an amazing verdict and are holding him accountable because we stuck to the truth. And so that's the biggest thing that I can say is sticking to what matters most brings healing and hope. And when we sit and just insulate ourselves with opinions that are just confirmed our own biases, we don't grow and we don't heal.
The healing process must have speeded up a lot since the result of that court process. How does it feel now that The Onion takes control and this could become an online comedy site? I mean, some people might even wince at the mention of that, but it feels good, does it?
It does. I mean, and just, I mean, the irony of the fact that you have Alex Jones dealing in conspiracies that have nothing to do with the actual truth to be taken over by a satire group on the other spectrum of not being truthful is amazing. I'm a big fan of The Onion, and I wasn't aware until recently that they had even been part of any of the bidders. It was all kept secret from us. And so I'm curious to see what they do with it. They're smart, witty people, and I'm sure they have a lot in the bag ready to go, and I can't wait to see what they do.
Has writing the book done you good too?
Oh, absolutely. The biggest thing about me writing the book is there was a lot that I lost. I lost Emily. And then because of the way I was handling my grief and the way that I had to try and protect my family from Alex Jones and his followers really disconnected me from who I am as a person and how I engaged in the world. And I had to get that back.
That was Robbie Parker, whose six-year-old daughter Emily was killed in the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School back in 2012. Don't forget, if you want to listen to NewsHour but you missed the live broadcast, there's a podcast of the programme available, updated twice a day shortly after we come off air. You need to search for BBC NewsHour podcast. Logically, you can also subscribe to the feed if you want to get it on a regular basis. I'm Paul Henley, and this is NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Henley with NewsHour, live from the BBC. The global health charity Doctors Without Borders has warned that the future of its operation in Haiti could be in doubt after at least two of its patients were killed when an ambulance was attacked earlier this week in Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince. Since 2020, much of Haiti has been in the grip of gang warfare, which has led this year to the storming of prisons, attacks on government institutions, and a state of emergency being declared. Médecins Sans Frontières this week said their staff had local police attacking them. The police were claiming they were trying to find gang members and seize control of their vehicle. Christophe Garnier is head of MSF operations in Haiti.
So the ambulance was stopped by the policeman who wanted to arrest the three wounded who were inside. And then they took it away in another hospital where our people, our staff, were asked to wait. After a while, we were told that for the police, the three people inside the ambulance were probably recognized as part of, let's say, gangs or whatever. And we didn't want to have any argument or any difficulties with the police. We're not here for that. We're here to collaborate the best we can. So we said, okay, no problem. We are okay to have these people admitted in another public hospital. After bargaining again and again, they told us that, okay, finally, you can go back to your hospital, MSF hospital, with the three casualties inside the ambulance who stayed in the ambulance all day long. And while we wanted to move out, then people from the community started to come and started what is called Bois Calais here. So they came back to the compound of the previous hospital. And then new policemen arrived, like maybe 40 policemen, with a high-level one who tried to bargain with us. And finally, the police didn't want to let it go. And they put some pepper gas in our car, forcing our staff to go out of the car. And finally, they took the three wounded, they beaten them, and they took them out of the hospital, and then our staff heard around 15 shooting. So we fully assume that two of them have been killed. I'm speaking about two because the day after we received an information that the third one, the youngest one, succeeded to move away. Probably they let him go.
Can you carry on operating in Haiti if these circumstances repeat themselves?
That's a very good question. We still don't have the answer. We still are questioning ourselves about our ability to continue our operations safely for the patient and for our staff and for ourselves. And we really want to have a guarantee that we are safe.
MSF is one of the last humanitarian groups still operating in Haiti. I suppose you can see now why the others have left.
Yes, and we are the major one. Speaking of health, I mean, health system in Haiti, it's around 30% of the system working anyway. So we are covering a lot. We plan to open a maternity very soon. We are taking care of sexual violence. We have a pediatric. We have health support, psychosocial support. We really are covering a lot and a lot. We are the only one having a hospital for burn. I mean, we don't want to stop, of course, but we don't want to continue if we cannot be safe, if our patients are not safe.
That was Christophe Garnier, who is head of MSF operations in Haiti. Now to the Solomon Islands, southeast of the Philippines, in the Pacific, the world's biggest coral has just been discovered there. The news comes as we hear so many stories about the mass die-off of coral around the world, killed by warming waters. The man who found this particular flourishing coral form, completely by accident, is Manu San Felix, a marine biologist and camera operator for National Geographic. He's been speaking to my colleague Tim Franks from on board a boat off the Solomon Islands.
I jump in the water free diving, and I was so lucky that I looked down and I saw in the first seconds that it was a single coral head, but huge. And I said, wow, this is something very special. So I free dive down, and I was with a smile blown away, because for me it's 44 years diving and thousands of dives, and I have never seen something similar.
Did you realize it was a single coral?
Yes, immediately. I am a marine biologist with a camera, and my passion is nature. So I came up from the first free dive excited and shouting to the dive boat, hey, come here, get the position, and call to my dive buddy, that is my son.
Tell me what it looks like. Tell our listeners what it looks like.
I have to say that is something beautiful. And I felt immediately, I was thinking, wow, this is here for hundreds of years. So many amazing humans that, as I don't know, Isaac Newton or Madame Curie or Napoleon, this coral was alive. Like when you look to a paint or a cathedral with hundreds of years, then you feel a respect. For me, that's amazing. And also thinking that this is created by a single polyp, that is a very simple organism with the capability in multiplying in millions of other polyps and surviving to all the ocean conditions. So for me, that is admiring. No? Well, I'm a biologist, probably a bit poetic, but all that things just were coming to me. And also because it's nice to come back with a positive and nice message, especially in these moments that most of the messages that we get from nature are terrible, no?
It is a wonderful discovery. And in the context, I think it's almost half of corals in warm waters are under threat. Do you think it's the fact that this coral was at a slightly deeper level than normal that means that it's been a bit protected? It's a bit cooler for this coral?
The health of this coral head, of this mega coral, is good. We were finding coral reefs in the same area, not in a good shape with the impact of bleaching, no, of the raise of temperature. I think we have the opportunity to learn a lot about this very old mega coral, because it's storing the information, what I said, of the conditions of the oceans. And now we have also the responsibility, another responsibility, of something wonderful to protect.
Marine biologist Manu San Felix. That was NewsHour. Thank you for your company. Goodbye for now. We'll be right back.
Available now on the documentary from the BBC World Service.
When rising sea levels threaten a country's very existence, how can its culture be preserved? Tuvalu wants to create an online archive of its language, music, and important artifacts. I'm going to find out how the government's Digital Nation plan is developing.
Listen now by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.